You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. Now, before I tell you about my guest this week, I have to tell you that Roisin Meets is partnering with Body and Soul. That is Ireland's most beautiful festival, which is filled with 3 days of music, art, culture and well-being. It takes place on the summer solstice weekend, June 22nd to the 24th in Ballinlough Castle in Westmeath. And 2018's edition of the festival includes Fever Ray, Chronix, Arca, John Hopkins, Playing Live, Iron and Wine, Baxter Jury, James Holden and the Animal Spirits. Head to bodyandsoul.ie to pick up a final tier ticket and be sure to check out the Irish Times programme on the Woodland Stage, which is taking place on the Saturday afternoon. And I can highly recommend Body and Soul Festival. It's absolutely brilliant, particularly for families if you're into that kind of thing. And sure, why wouldn't you be? Hopefully we'll have a lovely summer, not like the winter we've just had. Now, let me tell you about my guest today. She is the award-winning Queen of Teen, Juno Dawson. Juno writes books for a young adult audience, but I'd argue that they're perfectly suited to adult readers as well. And I'd urge anyone listening not to be put off by that categorisation. Her novels deal with serious topics in a unique way, and her 14th book is no exception to that. Clean tells the story of a teenage girl's battle with heroin addiction and a stint in a very, very posh rehab facility. It's billed as Gossip Girl Interrupted, and Marion Keyes loved it, saying it was compulsively readable. Juno was in Dublin to promote the book and came in to talk about it. We talked about loads of things, including her decision to undergo gender transition to live as a woman in 2015, having been born and raised as a boy. We also spoke about how reading the first Twilight book made her start writing herself, and she also hinted at an exciting top secret project which may or may not relate to Doctor Who, but she remained very coy about that. First of all, though, we began by talking about the fact that she'd become quite the frequent visitor to Ireland in her literary years.
I don't think I'd been at all until about 2014, and since then I've been 3 or 4 times a year to both Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland, sort of back and forth. And yeah, my books have been really well received.
And you've got a good audience here, like of young people who...
Oh,
like,
they're brilliant. Yeah. There's something slightly different about Irish readers, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your
we
ass or whatever
that,
the saying is.
We love smoke being blown up your ass.
We're treated like rock stars. I mean, I don't know if you can this year, I mean, I assume it's happening again, get down to DECON, which is the young adult convention that Easons organise. David Callahan is just an amazing bookseller. And honestly, it's like the Beatles are in town. And there's like all these, a lot of teenage girls, but they just wait outside the theatre for you and you're signing autographs. And it's really wonderful. And to be honest, you don't really get that in the UK. And I did, I think 2 years ago, I went to, and I will absolutely say this wrong, the Kurt Festival in Galway.
Kurt, that was very good, actually. Yeah.
And again, it was a Saturday morning and I think I was given 11 o'clock. And I was like, well, this is just going to be dead. And I got there and there's about 100 teenagers squished into this tiny room. And I was like, are you being paid to be here? And they were like, no. And I was like, did you have to come as like a school visit? They were like, no, it's just like nothing happens in Galway. So we just really wanted to come and we love your book. And I was like, this would not happen in London. Saturday morning in London, you'd be speaking to an empty room. So,
well, listen, we've loads to talk about. Your new book is Clean, mm-hmm. and it's a brilliant and a gripping read. And we'll talk later on about the young adult tag, because this idea that books are for certain age mm-hmm. groups, I'm not really totally down with it, because I'm not probably the target age group, but I'm really enjoying
Thank
it.
You.
And I think I'd hate for people to think that, you know, these you had to be this age to read mm-hmm. this book and that age to read other books. So we'll talk all about that. But I wanted to get to know you a bit more in terms of your background and growing up. So where did you grow up, and what was your family childhood like?
Yeah, so I grew up in Bradford, West Yorkshire, which is now better known as where Zayn Malik from One Direction comes from. Thank you for putting us on the map. Before that, it was Gareth Gates. Or Kimberly from Girls Aloud.
Kimberly, yeah.
And I grew up, it was my parents, very working class. I was born on a council estate. Well, a hospital near a council estate. And then, yeah, my dad was really hardworking and sort of worked really hard and kind of, he was that very Thatcher's generation. So he bought his council house, then they sold their council house, bought a bigger house in suburbia. And it was very much that. I was born a boy, As is well documented.
And did you have brothers and sisters? Or
one sister, yeah, younger sister. And that, you know, really was where it, I guess, was where it started. I do remember my mum being pregnant with my sister. And I guess it was probably around that time that I started to learn that there is a difference between boys and girls and how they're treated by their parents and by society and by teachers. And as soon as I was old enough to know, oh, you know, people in this society get treated differently, I knew, well, I think I want to be treated as a girl because that feels to make a lot more sense. On lots of different levels, really, even in just the way I pictured myself. So when I used to pitch myself as a teenager, it was never as a teenage boy. It was always as, like, Charlene from Neighbours or Tara from Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. And so, really, I can't ever remember thinking of myself as a boy, really. And, you know, it was only because of the generation into which I was born that I didn't do something about it sooner. So it was only really when I got into my 20s that I started to realise, oh, there is a word for people like you.
Although it took you longer to do anything or to think about it in a very considered way, were you able to have those conversations as a younger child?
Yeah, so from a very young age, I used to say to my mum, when will I turn into a girl? I thought that's how it worked, kind of, that like we were like some sort of like little caterpillar and eventually I would sort of just turn into a girl. And then you learn that's not going to happen. And the thing is, I've always been very, very careful that I don't want this to sound like I'm throwing my parents under a bus. There is no way on earth my mum and dad would have known what a trans child was. You know, it was the 90s. I remember once I was taken to the GP, and the GP didn't know the word trans either. And this was a medical professional. And so if my GP and my mum and dad weren't to know, then I don't see how I was supposed to know. I quite clearly remember my first, and it's so funny that this would stick in my brain, the first time I learnt of the existence of trans people. And that was through a dog-eared copy of Bella magazine in the doctor's waiting room. And it was about a woman, an American woman, who had spent thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds to look like a Barbie.
I remember that.
And
woman,
so that
yeah.
was like, so I was like, so you can become a woman, but it's like a quite a freakish thing. Like, this was not an understanding, sympathetic article about gender identity. It was about a freak. Well, it was a freak show to you, I suppose, and that's certainly the way the magazine presented her. And so, again, I sort of just shelved it. And through my teenage years, given that school was difficult enough.
Why was school difficult?
Because I was so feminine, you know, and we are told so clearly this is what boys should be and this is what girls should be. And, you know, I was just so girly. You know, my friends were all girls. You know, the way I interacted with teachers, you know, my pencil, I was very into all my pretty things and just, you know, and then it was tough. And I, you know, I always say this, before anybody receives homophobic abuse, you're shamed for running like a girl, throwing like a girl, you talk like a girl, you catch like a girl. And then as we became teenagers, that turned into homophobia because people made assumptions about me based on my behaviour. And you know, they were the wrong assumptions. I mean, actually, they'd got it right first time. You know, I did throw like a girl. They were absolutely right. But then
when they started to sort of say, you know, abuse about homophobic abuse,
yeah.
and thinking you were gay, and that's
yeah.
that's why you were a feminist. They were wrong in that.
Yeah,
instance.
And I think so. This is why, you know, I got myself into trouble with an interview last year, so I'm very careful now. You know, gender and sexuality are two completely different things. But a lot of homophobia stems from misogyny. And, you know, while I was a teenager, obviously, like as all teenagers do, not only was I figuring out myself, but I was also figuring out my sexuality. And, you know, when it came to crunch time, I knew that I liked guys and I've only ever fancied guys. And so the information that I had at the time, you know, Queer as Fuck, Will and Grace, Ellen, I knew what a gay person was. So I kind of sort of thought, well, you know, everybody says you're a boy and you like boys, so I guess you must be a gay man. And at the time I was kind of like, okay, that's good, that's fine. That means, you know, because up until that point I'd tried to visualise kind of making a happy family with a woman, and that had left me feeling very sad and strange. So I was happy and very kind of euphoric, I guess, in a way, because I could see a future for myself. You know, at least there is a boyfriend in your future, and that's a good thing. And, you know, that carried me through high school. It got me through university. And then it was later, after university, that I started to think, but no, something is still amiss.
Just at school, with all that going on and having to deal with that, so I suppose bullying of whatever nature it was, how were you as a student? Were you a swot? Were you good at your work?
Oh, such a swot. Because I think you can react to bullying in one of two ways. You can either completely opt out and truant, and we know that truancy for LGBT youth is sky high. But something, I don't know, I knew that my best way out of Bingley, which is the small
Bingley,
town where
sorry,
I grew up,
it's Bingley.
The best way out of Bingley was academic success. I knew that my choices were greatly improved with a whole bunch of exams behind me. And so I worked really, really hard. And I did well, but I wasn't the most gifted student. It was very frustrating that some of my girlfriends could rock up to exams on 3 hours sleep, drunk, and get straight A's, kind of. Whereas I had to really, really revise. And I did less well than they did as well. But I strangely, the older I got, the better I got. I think I basically cracked the system. I figured out how to pass exams, which I think is half the trick, isn't it? So,
And what did you want to do? Like, were you into writing when you were younger? Did you have aspirations that way?
Yeah, I've always written. Weirdly, I didn't think working class kids from council estates could be writers. You know, when I saw writers on TV, they were always proper posh, and I really wasn't. And so I was like, right, you should probably sort of get a trade, as my dad would have said. Weirdly, initially the trade was going to be pharmacy, and I did my work experience at a pharmacist. I really loved measuring out the little pills, and it was all super fun. But then I wasn't quite hot enough at my sciences at A-level, so I changed lane and went into clinical psychology. And I got my first at university, and I was offered a place on a doctorate, but then I just felt my heart wasn't in it, and so I went into teaching.
Okay, and that's quite a jump from the clinical psychology to teaching. And had teaching been something you'd always been in the back of your mind, or
no? I realised I wanted to do something that helped people and like a good person job. I mean, and again, this is no disrespect to my dad. My dad worked for a confectionery company until he retired. He worked for the same company, and I'd seen him get so stressed about sweets. And I was kind of like, this seems like a strange thing to give yourself a heart attack over, kind of. So I wanted to do something that helped people. But also, more selfishly, you know, all through my teenage years, I'd found a real release in writing. I used to what we would now call fan fiction, and also acting. I was in a drama group as well. And I saw teaching as a way that I could do both writing and drama and get paid for it. Unlike being an actor or an author, which is less reliable. So,
did you go into secondary school teaching or primary school teaching?
I did primary because I thought that was more like hedging my bets. So I could do a bit of drama, bit of English, bit of music. And what's frustrating about being a primary school teacher is that it should be the best job in the world. And it's the, and I can never say the word, the bureaucracy that stops it from being brilliant.
Yeah. So you were there and you were Mr. Dawson, I suppose, at that point, and Sir and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, very much. I mean, we now, I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? Because obviously my life did go this way. So it's hard to say what would have happened had I not got my book deal. I mean, the day I got my book deal in 2011, I was almost sea of kids.
Really?
Like straight out the door.
You jumped ahead a bit there. So how did that come about? So you were always writing, you said, fan fiction and doing various things. But when did you start to take it a bit more seriously?
So it was 2008. So it's 10 years. I remember it really clearly. I had borrowed a book off a girl in my class. She was called Lucy McGeekin. She's now a doctor, which is terrifying. And it was this book with this apple on the front. And I was like, how? And all the girls in my class were reading this apple book. And I was like, this must be one riveting apple. And of course, it was Twilight. And so I started borrowing loads of books from the kids in my class, like The Hunger Games, Twilight, Noughts and Crosses by Mallory Blackman. And I was just spellbound by this sort of reinvestment in teenage fiction, which hadn't really been around since I was a teenager when we'd had Point Horrors and Judy Blume and that sort of stuff. And I was like, oh, this is immense. But Twilight did slightly leave me wondering why Bella didn't have any mates. I was like, this guy isn't even that hot. He's a bit weird and he follows you and stuff. And he's like creeping into your bedroom. Like, we need to talk about coercive control, Bella. And so I thought, well, why don't you write a book about you and your friends? You know, except let's make you witches. And so I basically harvested my life at high school and turned it into Hollow Pike and made us all into this coven of Yorkshire witches, kind of, as a response to Twilight, a book I loved but had left me with questions.
So you sat down and created this world based on your own school life as witches, which is brilliant.
I turned that dust to gold. Yes. I seriously did, yeah.
And from the beginning, were you populating your books with these people who had different challenges, different stories, different identities and all that kind of thing? Was that really important?
Yeah, because that was another question that came about from the books I'd been reading. Now, the problem is, if you are only going to read The Hunger Games and Harry Potter and Twilight, don't be surprised when it's the same characters in them every time. And now, they're not massively diverse books. And I sort of figured, well, this is weird. You know, when you were at school, you had friends of colour and you had queer friends and bi friends. And so by that logic, if you had those friends, other people must have those friends. And I must admit, I really inhabited Hollow Pike with a very diverse cast, thinking that my agent or my publisher would probably take some out. So I thought, well, if I really ram it full of them, they can't make me remove every character. And as it was, I've never been asked to change a character. And, you know, the diversity of my characters has become something that, I guess, has become my calling card.
Definitely. And so you talked about growing up in a working class estate and coming through, you know, your dad having worked very hard to sell the house and all that. And the idea that being a writer from those backgrounds, and I think it's a really good point as well, because I always think of Catelyn Moran and her story, because they're very similar in that way. But when you had this book, you started it, did you approach anybody else, or did you think it's going to sit in a drawer, or were you really like, I'm going to do something with this? Did you feel confident in what you'd done and what you were doing?
I think the big thing, and again, it's one of those little stepping stones of fate that you don't even realise. My friend, lovely friend Sam, who's one of my best friends in the world, she was at the time working for Bloomsbury, but in the adult non-fiction division. So I stress this was not in any way, shape or form a way in. Mm-hmm. But Sam, she was like, you do realise you can just send publishers your book. You know, it's not, you know, people, I think, can slightly mythologise publishing to be like this sort of golden towers. And actually, it's not. Without authors and without manuscripts, publishing doesn't have a business. They need writers, and agents need to represent authors, or they don't have a business either. And so through Sam and through a bit of Googling, I joined an online writing community that has now, it's gone now, unfortunately. I sort of learned the tips and tricks of the trade slightly. And, you know, I Googled agents of authors that I liked. And that's how I found my first agent, and the rest is history.
We talked about you grappling with accepting I'm gay, and then it moved on. What was it in your adult years as a teacher that sort of made you start to think, actually, there's something else?
So the teaching years were quite full on. I was very happy living in Brighton, like seeing my friends, going out a lot, dating. And that's your 20s, isn't it? It was kind of figuring things out. The big turning point, although again at the time I didn't realise it was a turning point. When I got my book deal, I decided to move to London. I thought it would be beneficial for my career to be in the thick of it, and it was.
And you were saying bye-bye to teaching at this point. You were sort of throttle into the...
Yeah, I did. I quit my job. My first book deal, I got a really sweet deal. So I was able to give up the day job. That wouldn't happen now. Things that wouldn't happen in 2017. And so I moved to London. And strangely, to say that Brighton is a very queer city, not a massive trans community in Brighton. And so when I got to London and I got my column at Attitude magazine, and I was more immersed in kind of, I guess, what we would call the LGBT media. And through that, I started to meet trans women who were about my age. And I think that was the key thing, that these were trans women who were in their 20s and 30s, whereas before I had either met either very young trans kids, and in fact I'd had a trans kid in my class in Brighton, so I couldn't really relate to her experience because she was seven, or very much older trans women who I didn't really see myself in because they were in their 60s or 70s. And it was when I was meeting these younger trans people and I was interviewing them for a book that I wrote called This Book Is Gay, I started to realise, oh, because they were basically telling me my childhood. So I was interviewing these women and they were basically saying, oh, when I was growing up, I used to ask my mum, when will I become a girl? And I was like, you know, that's your life. And I suddenly realised, and I was a grown up, I think I was 28. So it didn't come as like, it wasn't traumatic. I was just like, okay, you need to sit down and deal with this, because now you know, what do you do with that information?
And what do you do? What did you do?
I was in a very privileged position. I paid to see a therapist. And this is where I have to acknowledge that I've had real opportunities and privileges that not all LGBT people are afforded. You know, I didn't have to do a wait list. I got myself on the internet and I looked up therapists who specialised in LGBT and gender issues and sexuality issues, found a great guy. And for the first, and I would say it was the first year of my transition, because obviously I was very invested in it mentally. The whole first year of my transition was just talking about it and trying to decide, is this why you've always felt at odds with the world? Because what if you go through this and you still feel at odds with the world? I mean, that would have been a shocker. So, and that was really good. Dean was my therapist. He was quite challenging. He really interrogated the beliefs I had about myself, the beliefs I had about my body, the beliefs I had about what it is to be a man or a woman in society. And at the end of all that, I felt going into the social and indeed medical transition was the right thing to do. And that was particularly from meeting with an amazing woman called Isla Holden. She's an RAF pilot. She found her life splashed on the news of the world because she happened to be Prince William's co-pilot. And yeah, I mean, she sued them and she did right, because it was not in the public interest for anyone to know that Prince William has a trans co-pilot. Well, I mean, what difference does it make? And it was through meeting Isla that I just saw this incredibly accomplished woman who was living her life with her partner, in her house, with her cats, you know, and vitally still a really good relationship with her family. And I was like, if Isla can do this, you can do this. You know, what are you waiting for? Just, you're wasting time. And I must admit, not once have I thought to myself, this wasn't the right road to take.
I've read in one of your glamour columns where you talk about people when they look at someone who's transitioning being obsessed with, I think you used the term, what's in their pants.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to ask you
about. Thanks.
No, but I think it's interesting because it's so prurient in a way. Like, and there's so much about our lives as women, as men, as whatever, that, you know, you don't want to necessarily talk about. But do you find that that's something that people want to know about? Or do you have now a stock way of kind of deflecting that kind of question?
Oh, you get so good at deflecting. Because, yeah, there is an obsession. I think there's an obsession with women's bodies, and I think it's a very magnified obsession with trans women's bodies. I've never been a trans man, so I couldn't say what that feels like in society. But yeah, there is a real obsession, which is very strange, because I think, and you know, this is obviously a conversation that Ireland is having at the moment about women's bodies and, you know, the function of women's bodies and, you know, the role of childbirth and motherhood. And, you know, I think it's really dangerous, because I think when we reduce women down to their, particularly their genitals / reproductive function, you end up in Handmaid's Tale. You know, we have seen this future. It's called Gilead. And that's why I think we have to be really careful that a woman is never defined by her bodily functions. I think it's really important, while at the same time admitting that the politics of women are often confined to her bodily functions. And so, yeah, like I say, I think you do just get good at sort of batting it off. Because, and you know, I always say, and I've said this to people on TV, you know, would you ask you know, when I've been on Good Morning Britain or This Morning, you know, would you ask each other about your genitals on television? So why do you think it's appropriate to ask me about my genitals on breakfast television? You know, and it's kind of like, you know, if you had the cast of Casualty on, so you'd be like, ah, so you've been playing Duffy on Casualty for 20 years. Could you now tell us about your vagina? It's just never going to happen. And yet for some reason, trans people, that's a perfectly on the table question. So I just think what's quite good is, right from the, because I think this interview kind of happened during my first year of transition. I watched the amazing Katie Couric interview with Laverne Cox and Carmen Carrera, where Katie Couric did ask them about their genitals on breakfast television. And both Carmen and Laverne very politely but succinctly shut her down and said, that's so inappropriate. It's like 11 o'clock in the morning. You know, why are we talking about this now? And Katie Couric, hats off to her, she said, I've learned from that. It was an incredibly intrusive question. As a nation, we need to learn from my mistake. And that's all you can ever ask for, I think.
Well, I suppose, is there a way of asking in terms of your transition? Are you at a stage now where you've done everything you want to do? Are you in a place now, having, you know, done the various things you've done, that you feel not at odds? Has it had that effect on you?
Yes. Yeah. Transition is, it's a lifelong commitment.
Right.
It really is.
Okay.
You know, I'm going to be on medication until I die.
Right.
Although I will say that that is a personal choice. Mm. You know, a lot of trans people either choose not to or cannot, for medical reasons, access hormone therapy. But I was in a fine flush of health. I was able to undergo hormone replacement, and that's great. But yeah, that is for the rest of my life. But the strangest thing is, it's almost more immediate than that, you know, because I did have to do my NHS waitlist, which is par for the course. So, you know, the first 18 months of my transition were what I would call my social transition. But that was good for my mental health. Mm. You know, it really is just about, and this is going to sound a bit woolly, but it's like I was carrying around this enormous secret.
Okay.
And for a lot of my life, I didn't even know what the secret was. And so as soon as I got rid of that secret and said, hello, world, some of you are going to think I'm a freak, but it doesn't matter because I can't pretend anymore. My name's Juna. I should have been born a girl. Something went wrong, but here I am now. I'm going to fix it. And I'm very lucky in that the vast majority of people in my life were like, brilliant, good for you. How can we help? So immediately I was like, oh, just such a weight off my shoulders, because I think sometimes, you know, quite wrongly, trans people are accused of dressing up. Actually, it's not. It's undressing. You're taking off a disguise to show who you've always been. And all that stuff, all the way I used to look, you know, I tried so hard to be a boy, you know, the gym, tattoos, beard, protein shakes, the whole nine yards. It was a disguise. I was trying to be something that I thought I was meant to be. And actually, this is what I was meant to be, actually. This feels so easy and so effortless. Don't get me wrong, huge practical considerations with being trans, abuse, transphobia, discrimination, prejudice, lots of waxing and hair removal, which all women will, I'm sure, appreciate. So you're sort of taking on this double whammy of kind of misogyny and transphobia at the same time. But none of it matters on a personal level, because it just feels like now I'm living the way I should have always lived. I mean, that's my only regret, that I didn't do this when I was 10, because I could have had my whole life this easy. Mm. If only I'd have known.
I want to get on to talk about your brilliant book now very shortly, because we don't have to talk about this the whole time.
No, it's fine.
But it is really interesting. I think the more people talk about it and we hear from people who have had your experiences, that it's good. It's good for us, you know. But the one thing I'm interested in, just you alluded to it there, is the transphobia. Mm. And something that I've noticed a lot is this, and I'm a bit, I'm not completely au fait with it, but this TERF thing, or certain women being very down on particularly trans women. I'm trying to get my head around it, because I suppose where I come from is like, whatever people are doing, I don't care. I don't care if you are a man or a woman or you're non-binary, or it doesn't affect my life. So I'm very much like, maybe that's a cop-out. I don't know. Maybe I haven't thought deeply enough, but that's kind of where I come from. But I noticed that there's people who have a lot of very strong opinions about what other people, how other people identify or how they... And is that something that you are grappling with, that you have to deal with, and or do you just kind of just shut it out? How do you?
It is, or rather I'll say it was. So I took a bit of a resolution at the beginning of this year that I'm just not going to engage with it anymore. I mean, I will say I don't use the phrase TERF.
Can you just explain what that is, actually, for people who don't know?
It's an internet term. It stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. But I realised this is... That sounds vaguely academic or credible, when really what we're talking about is prejudice and bigots. If you have decided an entire minority group is some sort of dangerous threat, like, we wouldn't call them Islam exclusionary radical feminists. We'd call them Islamophobes or bigots or racists. So I'm not going to give anybody that credible sounding term. And nor do I think it's particularly radical, because I think actually it harkens back to a very traditional notion of what a woman is and should be.
Can you put into words not using the TERF word, but what it is what's their problem is what
they just really hate trans people, particularly trans women. They think we are either predators, that we're trying to sort of take away the rights of cisgender women. But there's nothing really behind it. It is just, and it's a very odd hobby. Some people, and it's not just women, I was dressed as well, there's some men as well. They invest a lot of time in it. It's mostly online. It's mostly internet trolls just sending you hateful messages. But I must admit, you know, if you step off Twitter, I mean, I just block. When people start sending me abusive tweets, I just block them. You know, some people engage with them and some people try to argue. But I think that's not a great use of my time, actually. You know, I have a day job. I'll instead of writing little tweets defending my existence, I'll just write my next book instead. But and similarly, this isn't about feminism. And actually, feminist groups in Ireland released a glorious statement in support of trans women, saying, you know, we don't know what's going on in England with this craziness, because this isn't about trans women versus feminists, because I'm a feminist, all my friends are feminists and have been completely supportive. So I'm very wary of anybody, and this is why I don't use the phrase TERF, because this isn't feminists versus trans women at all, because, you know, in my mind, feminism is about moving all women forward, wherever they are in the world, however they look, and the colour of their skin, whether they're able-bodied, whether they're rich or poor. All women, not some women, all women, including women who, the way I see it, were born with birth defects, you know. And, you know, I've had a very strange life, but I've kind of figured it out now. And here we are. But more's the point, you know, I know trans girls who've been in schools since 9, 10, 11 years old as girls. And these girls need our help, because they're in schools now, you know, being pressured to send nude selfies and being pressured to take drugs. And, you know, these girls need feminism as well. So this isn't about feminists versus trans people. And nor was it ever. It's about a hate group versus trans people. And I hope that we can repay the favour. I mean, obviously, as English feminists, you know, we're watching what's happening here with your referendum on abortion so closely and trying to help however we can, because I think a lot of people in England just don't know it's happening. And so I think, you know, hopefully English feminists can repay the favour and support women's rights in Ireland to have autonomy over their bodies.
Mm. Well, they can read the current issue of British Vogue.
Vogue with Lynn Enright.
That's a great piece.
Gorgeous piece. Absolutely wonderful piece.
Yeah, brilliant. Just one more thing on that. You mentioned cisgender, and just for listeners who might not be aware, because I do think around all this language, and I hope you probably appreciate that there's lots of people going around who don't engage with these issues, who don't know, have any trans friends, who are in a kind of a bit of a bubble, not necessarily feeling any way discriminatory against anyone, but they just simply find it very confusing. Yeah. So can I just, that cisgender thing, is that?
You know, it took me a while. I had to Google it a few years back.
I Googled it earlier again. Yeah, I've Googled it a few times.
Cisgender, it's Latin for same, so it just means same gender. So it just means that you agree with the gender that you were assigned at birth, or the sex you were assigned at birth. It avoids having to describe not trans people as either not trans, which is strange, or normal, because then by default that would make me abnormal. I mean, so yeah, it's cisgender just means regular, I
guess.
When
I first heard it, and I don't know if you can appreciate this, but when I first, this is a few years ago when I first started hearing it, I got a really weird reaction. Like, I felt somebody was trying to diminish me as a woman. It's interesting, like, I don't feel like that anymore about that word, but there was something about being labelled. Like,
do you know what it is? That, I think that's why a lot of people don't like it, and I think that's why particularly a lot of cisgender men don't like it, because if you are a white, straight, cisgender, able-bodied man, you've never been labelled. Imagine what that would be like to go through. You've never had to say, oh, no, no.
I think that's what was going on with me.
Sorry, I'm gay.
Yeah.
Or, oh, no, 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 sorry, I'm a lesbian. Or, oh, no, I'm actually, I have a disability. Yeah. What if you've never had to sort of pronounce? And I suppose the thing is, if in society you're a cisgender woman who looks like a woman and has always been sort of clocked as a woman, no, I don't suppose you've ever had to say, oh, I'm Julia and I'm a woman. So it's that sense of having to in some way declare it. But, you know, I think cis, it's a politeness.
It's a polite thing. Yeah. It's not an insulting thing.
Oh, my God,
which is what I thought it was when I first ever heard it. And I sort of see now it's just a way of describing that's not insulting to someone else as well.
But yeah, anyway. It's because I think, yeah, with increased awareness around trans issues, there had to be a word for people who are not trans. Now, in my glamour column, given that my glamour column was aimed almost exclusively at not trans people, I deliberately avoided the word cisgender.
Did you? Yeah.
Because otherwise, you just had to define it every single time, kind of.
Yeah.
So
because you don't know who, if someone's read your column before.
Before,
or if
exactly.
They,
yeah. So I always referred to not hyphen trans. I created my own little not hyphen trans women, kind of. Yeah.
I'm going to talk about the book now because we need to. It's fantastic.
Thank
it's
you.
Called Clean. And yes. It's got a great sort of, it's a dirty business getting clean.
Yes.
And there's a lovely quote from Marion Keyes on the front, which says, compulsively readable and touching. I loved it. And I am 2/3 of the way through and I'm absolutely loving
Thank you.
Even though I'm not 18 and I probably shouldn't. I'm somehow, it's illegal for me to like this book because I'm too old.
No, oh my gosh, no. I mean, it's always the hope with a young adult book that they do sort of appeal to, I mean, let's not forget the word adult is involved in young adult. And so rather than for me seeing it as describing one category of people, a teenage reader, I think it stands for young and adult.
Right.
And both can enjoy it.
Young/adult.
Young/adult, yeah. I mean, I massively got into YA as an adult. You know, I was
Yeah, that's true, when you started borrowing those books. Yeah.
I mean, I was as a teenager, and then I was again as an adult. I mean, and I would defy anyone not to read Noughts and Crosses by Mallory Blackman and just think it's an absolute masterpiece. All the works of Patrick Ness, Louise O'Neill, Holly Bourne. These are books for everyone. Actually, some amazing stuff coming out of Ireland, because Claire Hennessy and Deirdre Sullivan are absolutely perfect
and Claire
as well.
Are brilliant, yeah.
Just so good.
Yeah.
And so I think there's some amazing YA out there. And if you're not reading it as an adult, I think you're missing out.
Yeah.
You are absolutely. And because I think the thing we do really well to sort of blow our own trumpet is it's incredibly readable and very accessible. Because if our core readership is teenagers, they are unforgiving. If the first chapter doesn't get them, that book is going straight to the charity shop. They will not. Whereas I think as adults, we will.
We're a bit more forgiving, aren't
we? We almost endure bad books.
So
like
true.
Refuse to give up on dreary, horrible books, kind of, because I will get to the end of this, kind of, if it kills me.
It will make me a better person.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it must be good for me if it's feeling so bad.
Yeah, like Weetabix or something. Yeah. You've got to eat them. It's good roughage. And so but I know through YA, I think the golden rule of YA is that, you know, you've got to really get them and keep them, because otherwise they'll just read Hunger Games again, you know, which is what they do. So, if nothing else, I'm like, treat yourself. Take Clean on holiday this year. That's my hope, because I think, I don't know about you, I'm a bit tired of thrillers in which it's the husband. You know, like, I think there was even one called It's Always the Husband. And I said, well, then we've come full circle now. If we're even calling the book It's Always the Husband. So I'm hoping Clean is a bit of an antidote to that. I think it's got that kind of glamour that you need for when you're by a pool. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of quite heavy stuff going on.
Yeah, but it's a nice balance because we do like the kind of how the other half live type of stuff, and there's a lot of that in here. So tell us about it. This girl who I really like, who I know isn't the most likable, which I also like about it. It's what I like about Louise O'Neill's books too. She doesn't try to make this character that you're going to like, who's going to be redeemed and is going to suddenly become this really nice person. This girl is like, she's quite the personality. She's her own. She's her own self. You know, she's very unique. She's the daughter of a very, very, very rich Russian guy, and she's grown up in hotels all her life and rich schools and poshness, and she kind of falls apart. She's only 17, but she sort of hits her rock bottom quite young.
At 17, which does happen. So yeah, she's called Lexi. She's a hotel heiress in the Hilton vein. And the book starts with her on her way to rehab. So from the very first line, you're in the middle of her intervention. And from then, once she has detoxed, which makes for a particularly grueling first 50 pages, once she has detoxed, she has to start unravelling. How can it be that a 17-year-old girl with the world at her feet has ended up addicted to opiates? And you start to sort of peel the onion and realise through flashbacks how she's come to be in this clinic. And then while she's in the clinic, she makes relationships with the other inmates, which has led to the catchphrase, "It's Gossip Girl Interrupted," which I think I am A-okay with that comparison.
Well, I just said Girl Interrupted when I was reading it, but that's great because I did read that in an interview. Gossip Girl Interrupted is a very good description. Mm-hmm. The other inmates are almost as kind of compelling as Lexi is. They've all got very different issues, but they all have that in common that most of them are very privileged. They've lived very kind of interesting, rich, high octane lives, and they've ended up in this place called Clarity, which is a great name.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't an opiate smoking, injecting person. I'm just going to make a guess here.
No, you guess correct. I was incredibly well behaved, like freakishly well behaved. I wish I'd been less well behaved. But
you obviously did a lot of research for this book.
I really had to rely on it. I chose in the end, although I was invited to attend a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, I decided not to because I just felt it wasn't ethically right for me to go and listen in on people's pain. Now, actually, as it turns out, they do have kind of open sessions in which speakers know there might be people there who aren't necessarily addicts, but it still felt there was an imbalance in power. So what I did instead was I spoke to a couple of friends who I knew had been through recovery, been through 12 steps. And then they put me in touch with other people who'd been through 12 steps, including, and I managed to find a number of people who'd been through sort of rehab in their very, very early 20s and could very easily trace back their problems to when they were Lexi's age. Mm. Because I did wonder briefly, you know, how realistic is it that a 17-year-old would be so far gone? But it does, you know, some people start young, and Lexi was certainly one of them. So, it sort of confirmed for me that I was certainly on the right track. In terms of the facility itself, when I was at school and then at university, two of my friends were institutionalised, one for an eating disorder and one for what we would now call bipolar. And so I got to see firsthand what life was like inside an institution. And I sort of toyed with that in one of my previous novels, All of the Above. But with Clean, right from the beginning, I knew that I wouldn't, myself as a 15-year-old reader, I wouldn't have read a really hard-hitting book about addiction, in that I came to Trainspotting and Junk by Melvin Burgess well into my 20s. Because as a teenager, I was really interested in Beverly Hills 90210 Saved by the Bell style gloss. I needed that gloss. I wasn't even interested in like Grange Hill and Hollyoaks. You know, they were too gritty. And so I thought, how can I take something as gritty as drug addiction and get me interested? Because I always write for myself, to be honest. And so I thought, well, why don't you take this institution and make it ridiculous? But the thing is, they exist, and they particularly
tell us about them,
because
this place is on an island in your book. It's, it is like the top hotel, the facilities, the chef, the horses, stables, like every kind of thing you could possibly want. So there are places like this.
Yeah.
And did you go and visit some?
I did. What I did was, again, for confidentiality reasons, I kind of had to go while it was being refurbished. So I went to one in Scotland. And so the Clarity Centre is a mixture of the remoteness of this one in Scotland. I mean, the island is completely fictional. However, it is truly like a mansion in the middle of nowhere. Mm. It was a bit old-fashioned, but it's fine. And then, I mean, the big one, the one that hits the headlines all the time, is the clouds in Arizona, which is the one where all the celebrities go. And so, yes, there is a lot of clouds. But I did on the
nar
about
whether... You didn't go to clouds, though, did you?
No. I mean, it's so far away. And there is, again, this huge ethical issues with dropping in on a rehab facility for the laugh, kind of. So I didn't go to clouds. I'd love to... morbid curiosity, I would love to see what clouds is like. And initially, we're talking very much in the planning stage, I did wonder about sending Lexi to a far-flung American, like Mojave Desert style clinic to get that sense of cut-offness. Mm. But then I loved the idea of her being abducted and not sort of knowing where she's going. And so for that reason, it couldn't, you know, she couldn't wake up halfway over the Atlantic. That would have been stretching it.
The book is done through the sort of the steps. Each chapter is one of the steps. And she's kind of growing and she's learning about herself. And it really is a kind of a... You know, you have assumptions about yourself and then you realise that the things that have happened in your life have shaped you. And I mean, it's brilliant on addiction, I think. But you've got some very good characters there of the therapists and the things they say. And she's a very quick-witted, intelligent narrator too, which is really adds to the book chipping along. But what did you want to achieve? Why was this and the addiction? And there's so many different people in it. So you've got Kendall, who's a trans woman.
Girl, yep.
And you've got someone who overeats, a very big girl. I can't remember her name.
Ruby.
Ruby. And then you've got this gorgeous guy, Brady, who I have to say, I would quite like to meet. He's like this reality TV...
has been.
The young son of one of these big families like the Osbournes or something like that. And you've got all these different people and they're all sort of broken.
Yes.
And they're in this place together. So it makes for great drama. I'm not surprised that I just read it's been picked up for a TV drama.
Fingers crossed, touch wood. Strangely, we'd sold the TV option before we'd sold the book.
That's amazing.
Which is the way the business works now. It's all moving along. I'm told there is a script. I have nothing to do with
it. So you're not getting involved in the... They just sold it away.
The writer, there's an amazing young writer on it called Anya Reese, who is incredibly talented. And so there's a bit of Lexi in her as well. So when I met her, I knew she was the right woman for the job. So I was like, you go nuts. And we have the same vision for the way the book could become a TV show. So fingers crossed. Yeah. I mean, anything can happen. It's a much more high-stakes world is television.
But going back to that about exploring addiction, you're obviously fascinated by it. And why was that? What was it that you wanted to kind of unpick for that younger audience?
I realised it hadn't been talked about in a while. I have my personal concern actually is in drinking, in that I see this happening a lot. That I don't know if there's a cultural difference between Ireland and England, but teenagers drinking to massive excess as if that's normal. And the problem is now I've had friends in their 20s who are now living the consequences of their heavy drinking as teenagers. And nobody's ever talking about that. Nobody ever talks about, like, it's all woo, it's like Skins, yeah, let's get wasted. And then you're like, oh, well, actually, I'm 32 and I'm in recovery. And, you know, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous since I was 26, kind of, and you're like, wow. Now, clearly, for whatever reason, in my family, addiction just doesn't seem to be in our DNA. None of my immediate family have addiction problems, but some of my extended family do. And so I've seen it, and it's so damaging. And I think the way we talk about it in schools was just fundamentally wrong. So the way I was taught it, and indeed slightly the way I then taught it, was do not do drugs. If you take drugs, you will be addicted and you will die. Now, the problem is with that, when you then take a drug and you do not and you don't immediately drop dead, you think, oh, it must be fine. I've been lied to.
Mm.
And so what I think we need to do is we need to change the narrative and say, well, no, odds are you're probably not going to drop dead the first time you do drugs. But this is what happens. You know, you've convinced yourself drugs are safe. Drugs are not safe. You don't know what you're buying. You don't know what's in the drug. You don't know the long-term effects. You can never guarantee what you're buying is what you're told you've been buying. You know, and this is, you know, speaking to people that I was speaking to, and it sounds, you know, a bit moral majority, but, you know, oh, I started out doing a bit of, you know, MDMA when I was 15. Oh, and then one time it was coke, and then one time it was crack, and now I'm a crack addict. You know, and where's that narrative? You know, because the first time he did the MDMA, I suspect probably had a good night, felt horrendous the next day, but then got on with his life. And so we need to be, I think, urging young people to see the bigger picture, and, you know, that you really do just have one body, and you need to be really, really careful with the things you're putting in it, because it just won't last. And, you know, when you're 15, and I think certainly this is so true of Lexi, she sees herself as indestructible. And then obviously something happens that we find out later in the book that has made Lexi realise she's absolutely not indestructible. And when you realise your own mortality, sometimes it's too late.
Mm. Oh, you've thought it very well. I think I really would recommend people of all ages to...
out now, Ireland.
Out in all the good bookshops. Else are you doing now? What's next for you? Have you written...
There's
the
another
one?
Book next
Because you're very
year.
Prolific. Is this your 15th, your 14th book?
It's ridiculous.
It's amazing, robot. Though. Some people... I thought it was like one a year, but you seem to do two or three books a year or something like that.
It's deceptive. I'll say this is deceptive because... If we're counting all my titles, we're counting books like Grave Matter, which was the dyslexia-friendly one, which was only 20,000 words. Okay. So that's like a quarter of clean. Spot the difference. Mm. A quarter of clean. So, and the non-fiction books were always much, much shorter as well. So it's a little bit deceptive. Mm. But I try to have one novel a year. That's the goal. Because what I love the best is the novels. And anything else always feels like a side hustle.
Okay.
Which is good.
And have you finished your next one? Are you writing your next one?
Yeah, so I write about 18 months ahead. Okay. So Clean was mostly written over the summer of 2016. And Clean was this very fast book to write because Lexi's life was in chaos. So I wrote it chaotically, and particularly the bit, and I hope, I don't know if you picked up on this, but once she's detoxed, she starts writing in full sentences. Mm. Up until that point, it's very staccato and strange. Yeah. So the next novel has just gone to my editor. I don't really, I shouldn't really say anything about it because it's just too soon. It's just too soon to talk about. But then there is another project which I'm absolutely not allowed to talk about because I've signed contracts and non-disclosures.
Has it got something to do with Doctor Who?
I couldn't possibly say. Just couldn't possibly say.
So very, yes, I think we can say it might have something to do with Doctor Who.
I couldn't possibly say. So who can say?
When can you talk about it?
I don't know, because I couldn't possibly say.
But you're very good at that.
I could possibly get sued. I really don't think I could. I don't want to get sued. Please don't sue me.
Okay, but you've got an exciting project.
There is
an
exciting project. Yeah.
Yes, okay. And many, many more exciting things I'm sure are going to happen to you. Just one thing before you go. You talked about your friends being very supportive. I was thinking about your family and your parents, obviously being very working class, probably not having any interactions with trans people when they were growing up. Was that a difficult thing to with your family?
Yeah, and I'm really happy to say because I get 2-3 emails a day from young people who've particularly read This Book Is Gay saying, oh, my mum is having a really hard time, or I'm scared to come out to my mum and dad, what should I do? And well, I'm not a therapist and I can never advise them whether or not it's the right thing for them to come out. I always say the thing that LGBT people need is patience. You can't dump news on your parents of any sort and expect them to be cool within half an hour. And I slightly made that mistake myself, which is I got a train up to see my mum. I kind of told her the truth. We went off and had a shopping day in Leeds. And I was like, oh, great, we've dealt with that then. She's on board. And of course, then she had a wobble because then she went home and thought about it and panicked and the sky was falling and there were tears and it wasn't great. But then I realised, yeah, she's going to take some time. And I think it's possible through the sort of the Caitlyn Jenner mould of transition in the media to see transition as a makeover that you kind of, it's like on Stars in Their Eyes, that you go behind a door and then you emerge on the cover of Vanity Fair, kind of. And it's just, it doesn't happen like that. And so luckily, you know, that was 4 years ago. And so now nothing happens wildly quickly. And so my mum had time to adjust. The biggest surprise was my dad, who was just insanely chill about the whole thing.
Really?
Well, now me and my dad have a relationship. I mean, that was the plot twist in all this, was that me and my dad basically hadn't spoken for about 5 years. And then finally we got it. It was that we'd never been a father and son. And he knows how to do father-daughter because he has my sister as well. And so basically he was just like, right, I've got two daughters. Mm-hmm. And honestly, this sounds trite, but we're closer than we've ever, ever been. And that's great.
And what about your sister getting used to not having a brother, but having a sister?
Oh, she's been great as well. Again, me and my sister didn't necessarily get on as teenagers, whereas now, yeah, she's been great. So good. But I'm so lucky to have had a family that have completely supported me. Mm. But again, it does take time. You know, it isn't an overnight thing. You know, and I would say, you know, to young people listening, that this, you know, you're gonna have, and it's not even a case of weeks. We're talking months and years. But I don't know if you can access it in this country. ITV One did a documentary called Transformation Street, which I took part in.
It was sort of reality TV about people.
Yeah, that's right. It was all through clinics. So I had a bit of work done last year, and they were like, because they knew me from my glamour column, and they were like, "Would you be happy for us to film your procedure?" And I was like, "Sure."
Didn't mind letting people into that?
No, it was cool because it was for ITV One at 9 p.m. and I figured, well, again, these are my glamour readers. These are readers who maybe don't have a trans friend. And sure enough, after Transformation Street went out, I got so many lovely emails from kind of women in their 40s, 50s, 60s who in like small northern towns saying, I never knew a trans person, but I've learned so much and I so enjoyed it. And isn't your dad lovely? And my mum didn't want to take part because she's just so not a TV person. But my dad took part and he played blinder. I didn't even tell him what to say. He was just really good.
Right.
So I don't know if you can track it. It's probably on YouTube.
Sure,
it'll be on YouTube somewhere.
Of finding it. Well, listen, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you.
Thank you.
Done on the book, on all your books, because, and I'll actually, this is the first one of yours that I've read, so mm-hmm. I'm definitely going to go. And what would you recommend after this one?
If you enjoyed Clean, I would say go back and read Margot and Me or all of the above.
And I'm actually kind of interested to read the first one, though, just on the basis that you kind of had this idea and it was like not the anti-Twilight, but it was a response.
Yeah.
So that's kind of really interesting, too.
Something beautifully naive about Hollow Pike is how I would describe it.
That's
beautifully
nice.
Naive.
Lovely. Well, Juna Dawson, it's been an absolute pleasure and the best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all we have time for this week. Big thanks to my guest, Juna Dawson. And just a reminder that her book, Clean, is out now. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time.